Hello and welcome to another edition of Proselytize or Apostatize. I'm your host, David Russell, and I don't have a co-host today. Oh no, where did he go? Anyways, besides that, we do have a very special guest on today. This is Dr. Fuzz Rana of Reasons to Believe. He is the Vice President of Research and Apologetics at Reasons to Believe. He is the author of several groundbreaking books, including Who Was Adam? Creating Life in the Lab, The Cell's Design, and Humans 2.0. He holds a PhD in chemistry with an emphasis in biochemistry from Ohio University. How you doing, Dr. Rana?
David, thanks so much for having me, and please call me Fuzz.
You know, it's funny. It's all the people with like three-letter first names. They always like Star Trek. You know, always call me Jim. You know, it's so funny. It's because it's easier, I guess. You know, David. You know, it's just it's long, so just David or Dave or. But we go by last names here because my co-host is actually David Paulman, so we just have all these Davids. And I do another show called Skeptics and Seekers, and my co-host over there, his name's David Johnson. So it's just, there's so many Davids flying around. So, but it's an honor to have you here today, sir.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a privilege to be with you too, so thanks.
Yeah, so I got a shout out to your publicists. I told you this earlier. They are amazing. They're so wonderful. They're so quick to respond. They get everything lined up and even ask if they could provide talking points. I love it. I don't know how you find these people.
You know, we're lucky, but yeah, we do have a great team of publicists at Reasons to Believe. We're just really, really blessed. Anastasia and Stacy do just an exceptional job for us.
Yeah, that's for sure. They're so wonderful to work with. Well, you know, Fuzz, I had you come on because I wanted to talk about hominids and evolution. So, I mean, I got a list of questions here, but first I want to tell you, thank you for this wonderful book. You just came out with it in November. Could you just tell us a little bit about it? Well, not me because I already know, but to the audience.
Yeah. Well, it's entitled Thinking About Evolution, and it's a multi-authored book where I'm one of the authors, but the author team includes Anjanette Roberts, who's a virologist. The late Sue Dykes, who was a paleoanthropologist. She died shortly after contributing her chapters, sadly. And then our friend Mark Perez, who's got a background in the philosophy of science. And we've essentially 25 questions that we think kind of get at the heart of some of the most important issues when it comes to the question of evolution. We're motivated to write the book because today, you know, the evangelicals and conservative Christians have, I think, a heightened interest in evolution more so than perhaps any other time in recent years, in part because there's a growing consideration among evangelicals and conservative Christians to contemplate the idea, could God have used evolution as a means to create? And you know, at Reasons to Believe, we take an old earth creationist position. And so part of the book was really just, we think about evolution and why we feel like an old earth creationist position is the robust position when we consider all of the data, the scientific and the biblical data.
Well, Fuzz, I have to agree because I'm an old earth creationist because of RTB and their ministry. So, yeah, you guys, you know, if it wasn't for RTB and your work and Dr. Ross's work, I don't know where I'd be. You know, you guys have given me so much confidence. And yeah, I'm fanboying here a little bit. I am a fan. So, yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for your ministry, I wouldn't have near the confidence I have now. And I just can't express the thanks for your ministry. And
well, thank you for those kind words. That means a lot.
So, guys, get the book, you know, don't just sit on your hands if you want to learn about it. I've already read most of Fuzz's chapters and some of Anjanette's, so it's been a great read. But, you know, I you said something earlier about how, you know, people are more interested in evolution right now. And, you know, I just off the top of my head, I agree. There's a lot of people that are more interested in evolution right now. And there's a spike among evangelicals and conservative Christians that are starting to adopt the theistic evolutionary view. Are you getting a lot of that as well?
Yes, I am. And, you know, it's understandable. There are a growing number of advocacy groups for theistic evolution, evolutionary creation. Most people are familiar with BioLogos today, which is an organization founded by Francis Collins, who is the National Institutes of Health and is a, you know, very prominent scientist who's an evangelical. But also there's emerging organizations like the one that my friend Josh Schwamidas has launched called Peaceful Science, where you have, again, advocates for that particular position. And part of the argument is, look, you know, evolution is the prevailing view among mainstream biologists for the question of origins. Today, there's compelling evidence for common descent, thanks to the work in genomics, where the human genome looks like it has shared features with the genomes of the great apes, and their case for evolution is compelling. And they also argue, too, that if we're going to be taken seriously as evangelicals by the scientific community, we really embrace the evolutionary framework. So, you know, these are not poor reasons by any means for contemplating, you know, evolutionary creation. And in my experience, people that are not versed in the science are actually more persuaded that in order to remain credible, we have to adopt an evolutionary framework and incorporate evolutionary theory into Christian theology. There is real concern about credibility. And so part of thinking about evolution was to show that there's actually very good scientific reasons to be skeptical about the evolutionary paradigm. And on top of that, that there are very good scientific reasons to think that there's a signature for a creator's handiwork when it comes to living systems, that we do see a creator's handiwork. And that, I think, provides an evidentiary basis for old Earth.
Yeah. You know, and you know, that kind of leads me to the first question here. And you kind of have in a way, and I appreciate that. But I mean, could you give like just a brief overview summary of your position on evolution and hominids? Just like briefly, and where the discussion is today, like fully.
Yeah.
Because before you do, I just want to preface that by saying, you know, there's a lot we hear, you know, and it's usually like we hear just certain portions of where the argument is, and we don't get like a whole summary of like, okay, this is where we're at, you know, so.
Right. Yeah. And kind of in a nutshell, my view on evolution is, I'm not an anti-evolutionist, though I'm skeptical about aspects of the evolutionary paradigm. So I think there's good evidence for things like microevolution, speciation, microbial evolution. But I really question whether the mechanism evolutionary biologists have identified can actually account for the generation of biological novelty, the generation of biological innovation. I think evolution and the mechanisms that we have available do a good job of fine-tuning existing designs, but they don't do a good job of generating those designs to begin with. And I'm also, of course, as a biochemist, very interested in the molecular life sciences, and that leads us to the origin of life question or the idea of chemical evolution, which I think very clearly we don't have good evolutionary explanations for the origin of the very first life forms on Earth. So I'm skeptical about, again, facets of the evolutionary paradigm, but I don't think I would position myself as an anti-evolutionist. Now, when it comes to the hominins, I would think of them in the same way as I would really think about most organisms that are in the fossil record, that they are representations of real creatures that existed, you know, on Earth, and that are no longer with us. But I would argue that the best way to understand the fossil record is that it is a natural history that is orchestrated by God's involvement, maybe not creating every organism that existed, but again, at least creating the core designs where again microevolutionary processes could vary them. So I see a creator's intervention throughout life's history, including with regard to the hominins. And so I would actually see them as distinct from humans. I don't see them as evolutionary predecessors to humans, but rather creatures that God created that existed for a period of time and then disappeared and then went extinct. And I would argue just one other point is that I think there's very good reason to think that only human beings have advanced cognitive abilities that would align with what we would understand as the image of God. I don't think the hominins possess those qualities. In other words, I think as human beings, we really are exceptional.
Yes, yes. And, you know, okay, so when I was studying this, when I first got into apologetics, you know, I picked up who was Adam and so forth, and creator in the cosmos, you know, I was really, I'm more of a sci-fi nerd, so I really like looking at the stars and stuff like that. I think that one of the reasons me and Hugh connected so well is because, you know, I had a telescope right behind me when I did the interview with him, and he was asking me about it, and I was like, yeah, I want to ask you about, you know, certain mounts, you know. But when I started getting into, you know, the evolutionary argument and the biology of it, you know, of course, you know, I don't know if I have it back here, but signature in the cells right there too. So, but where are we at now versus where we were at in, let's say, 2010?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, really, I mean, the focal point of the whole discussion is there evidence for common descent, and what and how do we understand the fossil record? And so for people that would advocate for an evolutionary view of life, they would argue that when we look at the genomes of humans and other creatures, we just see these shared features that they would argue only make sense if we are to interpret life from an evolutionary perspective. In other words, they would argue that there are these shared features that really don't make sense if you think about a creator being involved in producing life on Earth. And they would also argue that when we look at the fossil record, we see, again, different life forms at different eras, and there seems to be this progression, you know, that seems to explain, you know, again, the origin of biodiversity. So it's really the linchpin is really how do you make sense of shared biological features? How do you make sense of the fossil record? And, you know, one of the points that we try to make in the book, and we try to make elsewhere, is that it is possible to actually develop a creation model that would, in effect, explain or accommodate the data that many people think to be compelling and ironclad evidence for evolution. In other words, that same data could be interpreted both from an evolutionary framework and a creation model framework equally as well. And that's really a significant part of the book, and also a significant part of other work that we've done, like, for example, in Who Was Adam, as you mentioned.
Yes, yes. So it's kind of like, it sounds like what you're saying is there's maybe an interpretation problem. There's a lack of agreement in the starting point. I've heard you guys also say common creation, you know, like, you know, yeah, instead of common descent, common creator, you know, or common design, you yeah know, you guys still hold, yes, holding on to that pretty tightly.
I am. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I'm, you know, got a number of projects on the burner, and want to develop a creation model employing the idea of common design as a way and to see if that framework can account for the data that we see from genomics, and it can. But that's, again, a project that I've got, you know, kind of on the back burner that hopefully in the near future will give a lot more attention to. But yes, you know, one of the things that I think is important to realize is that when it comes to this discussion, of course, the scientific evidence is really very important. But also, we oftentimes neglect that there are philosophical considerations that actually influence how we would interpret the data. excuse me, methodological naturalism, which is the framework for contemporary science, actually found impact on how we would view the data. And in methodological naturalism, in a nutshell, just says that when you propose a scientific model, your explanation has to ultimately be based on mechanism. You can't appeal to the supernatural. You can't appeal to the work of intelligent agency. And so if you embrace that perspective, then a priori, you've eliminated essentially any kind of creation model from consideration, not because the evidence is lacking. It's because you've made a philosophical maneuver that constrains constrains a possible scientific explanations. And so when it comes to, you know, shared biological features or the fossil record, well, if you're embracing methodological, excuse me, sorry about that. So if you're embracing methodological naturalism, then the only, you know, option you have is some kind of evolutionary explanation and common descent. That's, again, a priori, you've limited that to being really the only viable explanation. So it's not because that the evidence necessarily demands it. But then on top of that, there's another philosophy of science principle that weighs in, and that's called the underdetermination problem, which basically says that scientific theories are underdetermined by data. What that means is that while the data may be consistent with a particular scientific theory, it never is sufficient to actually demonstrate that that theory is indeed unequivocally valid. In other words, you could have multiple theories that could be radically different from one another that could actually be supported by the same set of data. And so that's, in a sense, the point that we're making, is that a creation model, because of the underdetermination problem, is just as a suitable explanation for the data as is common descent. The difference is common descent wins the day among scientists because of methodological naturalism.
Yeah, it seems so. So, you know, let's dive in a little bit deeper now. You've already answered my actual second question. I'm sorry, I went off the script there. But I guess it's the nature of these conversations. Do pseudo genes prove common descent?
Well, yeah, this is a great question because it really provides us with a wonderful for essentially what we just talked about. Because pseudogenes are, in effect, one of the classes of so-called junk DNA that's found in the genomes of organisms. And, you know, when the human genome was originally sequenced and that reported, this would have been about 2000, the first analysis of it indicated that probably about 2 to 3% consisted of functional DNA. The remaining part, the argument went, was essentially non-functional DNA, that it was comprised of a number of different classes and types of DNA that looked like they essentially represented the vestiges of humanity's evolutionary history. And one of those classes is pseudogenes, which are believed to have been genes that were intact and functioning at one point that underwent a mutation, and that mutation disabled those genes. And what you note is that in the human genome, there are pseudogenes that are shared with chimpanzees. And so the argument goes, well, in the common ancestor, that gene may have been functional, but it then experienced the mutation, and that damaged DNA, that scar of evolutionary history, was retained in genomes as the two lineages diverged from each other. And so the argument is the shared junk DNA sequences provide compelling evidence for common descent. But if you can show that those junk DNA sequences actually are functional, then you could actually argue that those shared features reflect common design, not common descent. And over the last decade or so now, there's been mounting evidence that virtually every class of junk DNA, including the different types of pseudogenes, have functional roles, primarily playing a role in gene regulation. And in fact, there's now an idea called the competitive endogenous RNA hypothesis that actually explains why pseudogenes have similarity to the so-called intact and functional genes, and that similarity is critical for their role in gene regulation. So in other words, the more that we've learned about the human genome and the genome of other organisms, the more that we're seeing that the features that we thought initially were junk actually turn out to be critical and vital functional characteristics of the human genome. And that is, in effect, what you would predict from a creation model standpoint. So it really represents a successful prediction on the part of the creation model for, you know, the net.
Wow, that's really interesting. Let's go to nested homologies. Do they prove common descent?
And again, it would be another case study. But here, the argument goes is that not only when you compare like the human genome and the chimp genome, do you see these shared sequences, but then when you look at groups that would naturally cluster together, and that you could have kind of groups within groups within groups, that would be a nested hierarchy, that when you look at those groups, you also see genomic features that also display that same type of nested hierarchical pattern. And so the argument would go, the only way you could explain that is, again, through common descent and through an evolutionary history. But again, you could argue that nested hierarchy reflects, in a sense, genetic archetypes that would be stacked on top of each other, and that could produce that same kind of pattern. So an example that might be helpful here is to think about the history of the automobile. We all understand that the automobile has undergone an evolution, right? And we can document the evolution of the automobile, but we recognize too that the automobile was the work of a mind. It's designed. And that when there has been major automotive design, once that innovation has happened, that innovation is retained in future models, so that when there's another innovation on top of that, you now have stacked archetypes, if you will, that would form this nested hierarchical pattern or these nested homologies. So the point being, I think you could explain nested homologies through a creation model approach just as you could through an evolutionary model. And again, the preference would be influenced by, again, whether or not you embrace methodological naturalism as the framework for doing science.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, is it comes down to that framework and how you're approaching it. That's what it sounds like to me. So, I mean, what is the best evidence that you think, besides some of the things we just discussed, against ape-human common ancestry? What do you think is the best?
Well, you know, to me, I would go back to the shared so-called quote-unquote junk DNA sequences, because those DNA sequences, were the work of a creator. Then to see that degree of extensive commonality makes, you know, sense from a creation model standpoint. But if these sequences arose through evolutionary processes where the sequences were functional, then they lost function to form junk DNA sequences and then regained function through an evolutionary process, that's referred to as neo-functionalization, you know, kind of acquiring new function where you're proceeding through a stage of junk DNA, that could account for some classes, or at least some sequences of junk DNA having function, but it couldn't account for the pervasive function that you see in the human genome and the chimp genome for these so-called junk DNA sequences. So to me, it's the pervasiveness of so-called function in junk DNA that I think is problematic for an evolutionary explanation, because it's one thing to say a handful of junk DNA sequences regain new function through neofunctionalization. To say that this happened on a wide-scale basis to me seems harder to bite off if I'm, you know, looking at life in through the lens of evolution.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, this really gets us to the hominid issue that, you know, I kind of want to transition now, since we're about halfway done already, and this is, I'm just blown away. It feels like we've only been here for 5 minutes. you know, you kind of explained who the hominids were and who you thought they, or not who they were particularly, but you know, kind of like what they were, you know, as according to the evolutionary, but who were they? I mean, can you go through and just kind of give us a brief overview of actually who these guys are and, you know, where they come from and so forth, and maybe even how we got to, you know, find them and so forth.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the most remarkable achievements, in science in the last 100 years has been really the discovery of the hominin fossil record. You know, we see, I don't know, there's it's hard to ice number of hominin species that have been discovered, but these are creatures that essentially are primates that walk erect, and they go back to about 6 to 7 million years when we look at the fossil record. And there's a wide range of different species that are represented by different genera. For example, we have Sahelanthropus and Ororan. We have Ardipithecus. These are very early hominins that appear, you know, in the 6 to probably 4 million year range. We have the Australopithecines. These would be creatures like Lucy that people would be familiar with. And then we see at about 2 million years ago in the fossil record, the Ogenus. And arguably the first member of the genus would be Homo habilis. Homo habilis also has the important status as being the first hominin that unequivocally utilized stone tool. And then we see Homo erectus appearing about, I don't know, 8 million years ago, persisting till maybe about 1 million years ago, or maybe even 500. And then from there, we see a number of hominins that are sometimes called the archaic hominins. They would be creatures like Homo heidelbergensis and creatures like that, including Neanderthals. And then, of course, modern humans appear in the fossil record, you know, probably roughly 150,000 years ago, thereabouts. And so that's kind of a broad overview of the hominin fossil record. And these hominins are found primarily in Africa, but we do see hominins that have been also discovered in Asia, the Middle East, and in Asia, particularly with respect to the Homo genus.
Wow, that's interesting. I just want to go back real quick to Homo habilis, right? My co-host, he's the one that asked this one. What are we to make of Homo habilis? Because, you know, it seems like every time they find a fossil they're not sure about, they connect it to the Homo habilis, you know, or is it just something random, or is there actually really good evidence that this Homo habilis actually existed?
Yeah, well, you know, is bringing up a really important point, and that is that it's very difficult when you look at the hominin fossil record, the precise number of species, how to actually group or catalog individual fossil finds into a particular species. Interesting difference in philosophy among anthropologists. There are what are called the lumpers and the splitters, where the lumpers tend to kind of group fossils together into smaller numbers of species, whereas the splitters tend to break up those individual fossils into myriad species. And so Homo habilis is kind of caught in the crossfire, where some people think, well, Homo habilis and Homo rudolfensis should be, and Homo georgicus should be part of the same species. Some think that they are individual species. Some think that these were the transitional form that connects the Australopithecines to Homo erectus. Others think that they are a side branch. So there's quite a bit of debate as to really, was Homo habilis a single species? Were there multiple species that were very similar to one another? And because of that, individual fossil finds might be interpreted differently from paleoanthropologists to paleoanthropologists in terms of what species they belong to, but also in terms of where they are positioned in this hominin evolutionary tree. You know, and part of the issue is these fossils that we have are many times we have a species defined by a single fossil specimen, or we might have a handful of specimens, but these specimens are located at different times and in different geographies, and we don't have a robust enough sample to begin to understand the natural range of morphological variation over time and over space. And without that understanding, it becomes very hard to know how to categorize individual fossil finds. So Homo habilis is a great case study that demonstrates that problem, but that problem is not unique to Homo habilis. That problem is also seen elsewhere as well.
Hmm. So, you know, I know I kind of figure what you're going to say, but what do you think, or what makes you most skeptical about the claim that modern humans come from hominids?
Well, I mean, I think it's very clear that we do share obvious biological similarities to the hominins. But again, those similarities could be understood as evidence for common design versus common descent. But for example, there are features that you see in the hominin fossil record that I think are inconsistent with an evolutionary interpretation. So for example, when it comes to the ability to walk erect, our bipedal capabilities, bipedalism shows up suddenly in the hominin fossil record. There's no clear evolutionary emergence of bipedalism from a knuckle-walking quadruped, which is what you would expect. Moreover, we obvious evolutionary driving force that would cause that transition to take place. It's things like that where there are features in the hominin fossil record that to me don't square with an evolutionary interpretation. When we look at brain size, we see these discontinuities. So you will go for significant periods of time where there's stasis with respect to the average brain size. And then when a new species appears, there's a sudden dramatic increase in brain size that, again, we see it remaining static. That's not the kind of mode and tempo I would expect from an evolutionary view, but exactly how I would expect to see it if a creator was involved. Also, we cannot document a pathway through the hominid to show unequivocally the emergence of modern humans. It's very clear that there is a hominin fossil record, but we don't know what were the hominins that were actually in the lineage that led to modern humans. Most of the hominins that people traditionally think of as part of our lineage are most likely evolutionary side branches. So Lucy is questionable where she fits Australopithecus afarensis, where it fits in the, you know, this hominin, or in the sequence leading up to humans. Increasingly, there is a view that afarensis was a Homo habilis's status has been questioned. Some people have questioned whether or not Homo erectus is part of our lineage, antecessor, Neanderthals, Homo heidelbergensis. So there's all these question marks as to which hominins would have been in the lineage that led up to modern humans. And so in absence of that, I'm not really compelled to think that I've got to view the hominin fossil record in evolutionary terms.
Yeah, I was going to ask you next was, how are humans qualitatively distinct from other hominids?
Well, I mean, there primarily, I think our what distinguishes us is our behavioral capacities, where it's very clear that anatomically and behaviorally modern humans stand apart from other hominins in the fossil record, including Neanderthals, in our sophisticated and advanced cognitive abilities. And there is also some distinctives that we have with regard to anatomy that also distinguishes us, particularly our globular skull and the nature of our facial structure. Our face and our is unique compared to the other hominins, and our skull, instead of being elongated, is globe-like. And this actually has some profound impact on the structure of our brain, the fine structure of our brain, where modern humans have an expanded parietal lobe compared to Neanderthals and other hominins. And that expanded parietal lobe is critical because it's the part of the brain that's involved in the process of math and language. And it's also the part of the brain, interestingly enough, that goes quiescent during religious experiences based on functional magnetic resonance imaging. So there's something that appears to be qualitatively different about us with regard to our skull anatomy. And that difference actually helps to explain our uniqueness and our exceptional nature when it comes to our cognitive abilities. So I think that's probably what distinguishes us. And, you know, as somebody who is again, an old earth creationist, I note that when I look at the Genesis 2 creation account, it's very interesting because we see Adam, the dust of the earth, and God animating Adam with the divine breath, which I view as being imparting to Adam the image of God or his spiritual nature. The beasts of the field and the birds in the sky are too created from the dust of the earth, but they are not animated with the divine breath. And so what that tells me is that as humans, we're made out of the same stuff as the animals. We come from the earth. The animals come from the earth. We're made out of the same stuff, but yet there's something that causes us to be distinct, and that's the image of God. And that this what makes us different is really our spiritual capacity, the imago Dei that's in us. And so I would expect, if that's the case, that when we look at the hominid fossil record, we should see biological similarities, but where we should see the biggest difference would be in our behavioral capacities, which I think are going to be a reflection of whether or not we have the image of God and whether or not hominins have something comparable to the imago Dei. And I think that's where this distinction biblically, and I think that's where we see the greatest distinction scientifically.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. Because you look in Genesis and there's obviously a difference between let there be, right, versus bara, right? There's obvious difference there. And I love the way you guys brought that out in the teachings I've heard from RTB over the years. So I mean, how?
Well,
Okay.
I mean, towards that end, when we look at the Genesis 1 account with regard to the creation of male and female in God's image on the sixth day of creation, it's interesting that there are verbs that are used there. One is asah and the other is bara. Both are ascribed to God's direct and personal involvement in the act of creation, but asah is to create something new that from a pre-existing material, where bara is to originate something new that's never existed before. And so that is telling us that really there was a two-stage creation to humanity, which I would understand as our physical makeup and then what makes us unique, which is our spiritual capacity.
Yeah, that's it's amazing when you actually go through the scriptures and you actually look at the Hebrew words and decipher them, like I did the same thing. I consulted lexicons and writings of Gleason Archer and so forth, and it's amazing. It's amazing, like when you actually take a look at it, there is that difference there. There is that pops out. I don't see how people can ignore that, especially your young earth guys, you know. But anyways, to move on, you know, you said something very interesting about behavior and stuff. Now, as a person, you know, I couldn't live with another, I guess, an animal and consider, you know, it being my spouse or whatever, right? But there's obviously some inbreeding going on there between Neanderthal and humans. So how, and this is, you know, this is just a guess, how close were the Neanderthals to us in that way? So, I mean, how detailed, like how close were they actually, do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, to me, it's clear that Neanderthals really are a distinct species from humans. And I, you know, the there are anatomical differences between humans and Neanderthals that I think you're justified on those differences alone to view Neanderthals and humans as being distinct. We also have enough Neanderthal remains that we can actually document the developmental trajectory of Neanderthals as they grew from infants into adulthood. And it really does look like that developmental trajectory is very different. And then lastly, there are genetic differences as well. And the genetic differences that we see primarily between humans and Neanderthals is oftentimes with regard to genes that are connected to cognitive capacity. So I think there are clearly, you know, distinctives between humans and Neanderthals that, again, justify viewing the two as different species. And I think when it comes to behavior, again, there's very good reason to think that Neanderthals were not our equal, that they were cognitively inferior in some rather important ways. Yet it's very clear that they did have some emotional intelligence. Some emotional capability. And I think such that we could probably have formed, quote unquote, a bond or a relationship with Neanderthals, just as you're pointing out, David, that we can form bonds and relationships with other. And this is not to say that Neanderthals were just, you know, they were in their own right remarkable and impressive creatures. I just don't think they were like us in that they had, whereas we possess the image of God. So they would be part of that group of creatures that were not suitable to be a helpmate to Adam, to human beings. But yet seem to be growing data that indicates that there was some interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals. And I think that could be possible because, again, of the shared designs that we see between humans and Neanderthals. When I look at Scripture, I do see, for example, in Genesis 6, these instances where, you know, there appeared to be some kind of interbreeding going on. I don't know exactly what's going on in the text there, but it was interbreeding that God was not really pleased with. And so could it be that humans and Neanderthals interbred, that was not, you know, pleasing to God, but it was something that happened in part because of our depravity as human beings. You know, I think it's very interesting that, you know, Adam went through this elaborate process to study the animals, to recognize that none were suitable for him. Yet when we get into the Levitical law, there are very, very clear prohibitions against bestiality. And so, obviously, in our fallen state, humans had this, you know, this tendency to not understand the needs that God put in place. And so, I don't find it surprising that humans and Neanderthals interbred. And of course, this leads to some very sticky questions about, well, did the human Neanderthal hybrid have a soul, the image of God? You know, and we can only really speculate on that. I think it's very clear that there was interbreeding that happened. But from a biblical standpoint, there's nothing that I think rules that out as a possibility, nor does I think that interbreeding argue that Neanderthals were like us in any sense of the word.
And, you know, let's speculate just a little bit. And this is for fun, okay? Could Cain's wife have been a Neanderthal?
You know, when you sent the questions over and I read that, it's like, you know, that's the first time I've heard somebody speculate along those lines. Because a lot of times I hear people say, well, maybe the Nephilim were the human Neanderthal hybrids, which isn't, you know, an outlandish thing to contemplate. But you wonder, I mean, you know, could some of the mentions that we see, for example, of Cain's wife, are the other quote unquote people that were outside the garden in reference to Neanderthals, you know, as opposed to really descendants of Adam and Eve. So these are fun things to speculate on, but I think, you know, and I don't know that we could ever really come up with a great answer one way or the other, but I think the larger point, even though we're having fun with this, the larger point I think is, you know, that there is latitude within the biblical creation accounts to accommodate interbreeding and to even see it as you know, towards the end of Genesis with regard to Joseph, you know, and what his brothers did to him is that while his brothers intended it for evil, God was able to use it for good. And could that interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals be, you know, evil, but yet God is able to work it for the good of humanity? And so there is some evidence that the interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals did a positive role in preparing humanity to migrate to different parts of the world, particularly during different types of pathogens. So, you know, it's a messy area, you know, that if I had my choice, I would love that there was no interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals, but the data is, and yet again, I don't think that data demands us abandoning old earth creationism in favor of evolutionary creationism. I think there are ways to address those concerns.
Yeah. So, I mean, I heard you say, you know, you were in a workshop, and William Lane Craig was there, and you know, you had some theistic evolutionists push back on you, and mm-hmm. What is your general thought on theistic evolution? And this is, again, this is just for fun. You could just, I mean, you don't even have to answer.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what are your thoughts on that type of theology? I mean, again, I know in your book, you say, you know, there's some philosophical issues with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, to me, you know, I'm not a theistic evolutionist because I think there are places where the evolutionary paradigm lacks explanatory power, at least as it's currently constructed. And one of those places has to do with the origin of what I would exceptionalism. Nobody can explain how you go from animal communication to the emergence of open-ended language that's built upon symbolism. That transition is inexplicable from an evolutionary perspective. And so that would be one example where I see the evolutionary paradigm as being deficient. And I do have some biblical concerns, particularly with the historicity of Adam and Eve. It's very difficult. Adam and Eve is not only historical, but being the sole progenitors of all humanity from within the framework of theistic evolution. You know, I do see some philosophical concerns about the nature of evolutionary mechanisms, and is that really truly compatible with God using evolution as a way to create? So those I have, but, you know, I do think that it's important that there are people that advocate for evolutionary creation. I don't think it's a position that undermines the Christian worldview, you know, or that people could hold to that position and have a high view of Scripture, you know, and be, you know, devout, committed Christians. And so I don't see that position as a threat, if you will, or a heretical position. I think it's a valid model that needs to be discussed. And you know, to me, I think we're at a point right now where there's increasing interest in the question of human origin among evangelical scholars. So you have the people at BioLogos. We have Josh Swamidas with his book, The Genealogical Adam. We have William Lane Craig, who's got his own model that has some overlap with our model at Reasons to Believe and some distinctives. And I think he has a book coming out there. But I think it's a great thing that there are these proliferation of models that incorporate facets of the evolutionary paradigm to differing degrees. But I think it's a really good thing because it means that as a church now, we have a rich set of options available to people who are wrestling with the issue of human origins. And we have a rich set of models that we can present, you know, to non-believers as to how they can make sense of the human origins account and retain scientific credibility. I think the model we have at Reasons to Believe, Josh Swamidas's model, William Lane Craig's model, all have some very real scientific credibility to them that aligns with a lot of mainstream science. And so it becomes a way to I think, build a bridge to the gospel, the question of human origins. And so I think this is a really good thing. And, you know, my hope is that instead of adopting kind of a territorial posture, you know, other Christians, that we actually say, hey, here's my model, this is your model, let's now engage, you know, in an ongoing set of workshops where we kind of work through our differences, places of agreement, places where we can begin to build consensus. I think that is really what the church needs, and I think that's really what will be ultimately healthy church, and what will lead to, I think, a robust model for human origins that really does the best job of accommodating all of the considered philosophical and biblical.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is going to conclude our you know, more serious. We did have one fun question in there, but I got a couple more fun ones. All right.
Okay.
You can decline if you want, because I didn't put them on the paper. But you know, there's a lot of bad arguments out there, but with evolution and stuff. And how would you respond to some of those questions that come up? Like, okay, so. Do you see apes changing to humans today? What would you say to that?
Well, that idea, I think, fails to recognize that nobody is claiming that humans evolved from chimps, but rather that humans and chimps share a common ancestor. And that's why we see apes today as well as humans, is because we are both viewed as being descendants from a shared ancestor, at least from an evolutionary perspective. So not a good argument.
No, not at all. What about the no transitional forms at all? Now you hear people misrepresent that one a lot too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think when it comes to the hominin fossil record, people would immediately point to the transitional forms there that we see, or saying, well, these are clearly transitional forms. Now, one of the things that I think is interesting is that the concept of a transitional intermediate is actually ambiguous. So oftentimes when Christians use that concept, they're referring to a sequence where organism A gives rise to organism B, organism C, and ultimately, you know, to the final organism in that chain. But there's another way you could think of transitional forms, which would be organisms that exist between two time points. And so what happens is, I would say there are no clear transitional sequences that we see in the hominin fossil record documents of modern humans. And there I'm looking at transitional forms in the former definition as a chain of organisms that are connected to each other. But may say, well, but look at the hominin fossil record. That's evidence for that's evidence for transitional forms. They're using the second definition, that these are organisms between two time points. And then the argument goes, well, We see these organisms between two time points. We don't know how they might be related to each other in an evolutionary sense, but we're confident that they are, because they are essentially viewing the hominin fossil record, in this case, through the lens of evolution. So the idea of, when somebody uses the concept of a transitional intermediate, I think it's important to ask them, what do you specifically mean by that, right? And so, yes, there are evidence for transitional forms in the fossil record, but there's also ways to understand those transitional forms from a creation model.
Yes, yes. And you hear that, folks? There's actual good ways to ask questions and not misrepresent the whole paradigm when you're doing it. So, last one. I heard you debate Aaron Raw, and I can't remember what was your say on his phylogeny challenge or whatever it was.
Well, I don't remember, but I do think that ultimately, I don't remember what I said to him, but let's put it this way. Phylogenetic trees are not evidence for evolution.
Right.
Okay. What they are is an interpretation of shared biological features from within an evolutionary framework. And to just to use a silly example, I can take things that are designed, that I know are designed, and I can build evolutionary trees with them. I mean, if you just go to your silverware drawer, right? If you're lucky, if you don't have kids that destroy your silverware
sets. Well, I do have some that are like that a little bit.
But you actually have silverware that all form the same set. And so there's certain features of the silverware, like with the handles, that are the same for the forks and the spoons, but that the fork and the spoon are obviously different. And so I could actually build an evolutionary tree out of my silverware drawer, you know, looking at similarities and differences. And I could actually propose different evolutionary trees
based off that
would essentially take into account the nested hierarchical structure that you see in a silverware drawer. And so the point here is that, again, phylogenies are not evidence for evolution, but it's an interpretation of shared similarities and differences, again, through the lens of evolution, where you're building trees. And there's not a single evolutionary tree that comes out of the data, but rather it's a collection of trees that, and then evolutionary biologists are using to actually try to determine which is the most likely evolutionary tree. This is called a parsimony analysis, or using the principle of parsimony to try to determine, or Bayesian analysis to try to determine which is the most likely evolutionary tree. So evolutionary trees are hypotheses about what the evolutionary relationships are. They're not evidence for evolution.
So what you're kind of saying there is that, you know, they're kind of using evolution to prove evolution true. In a way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to me, you know, you'd have to use something else as evidence for an evolutionary history, not the phylogenetic trees. Yeah, exactly.
Right on. Well, folks, you heard it from Fuzz Rana today. Fuzz, do you have any, I mean, this concludes everything here. So, I mean, do you have any, would you like to plug any websites, anything like that?
You know, I think the best thing for people to do is, if they're interested in some of the things they've heard today, is go check out our website, reasons.org, you know, or follow us on social media. You know, it's RTB_official. That would be the best way to kind of stay connected to us. And but visiting our website is worthwhile. We typically, in the course of a week, will have a number of new resources available to people, blog articles, videos, podcasts that are accessible at no cost to the user. So that will give you the latest insight into science and how it relates to the Christian faith. So if you're interested in the science faith conversation and you want to understand the old earth creationist view on science and faith, reasons.org.
Yes, guys, I suggest you go there as well. All of these links will be in the description of the video. And yeah, that's it for today, guys. Stay tuned tomorrow for what you see in the left-hand bottom of the screen there. We're going to have a panel discussion on eschatology. Should be fun. Stay tuned.